Good morning. And of course, welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I don't know if we have any visitors, but I think you all know who I am. I am Sandy Ingham, the minister here at Prairie. Prairie aspires to be both open-hearted and open-minded, and of course we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, your sexual orientation, your family structure, your gender, and I hope your political affiliation. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. On Sunday mornings, as I think everyone here, almost everyone here knows, we provide a variety of programs. Sometimes I do the program, often someone from within the congregation does the program, and sometimes we have outside speakers. So we urge you to come more than once. These, then, are the opening words, and this morning I'm trying to mix a little whimsy into our Thanksgiving celebration. So this is kind of a little story, not exactly opening words. Pilgrim Winslow by Jane Zepka. Apparently, Pilgrim Edward Winslow wrote the only eyewitness description of the first Thanksgiving. In his brief letter to a friend in England, Winslow described the joy, the celebration, and the carousing that followed the harvest of 1621. That first to-do seems to have been like harvest home, some of you may know what that was, back in England in the 1600s, harvest home, cakes and ale and hang the cost. Pilgrim Winslow makes no mention of thanks. Uh-oh. We find out that the religious component of Thanksgiving and even the act of giving thanks are later additions. Isn't that just the way? At any given time, we're busy with our cakes and ale and turkey feathers. It's only later, looking back, that we understand the gravity of our harsh winters, the fragility of daily life, the preciousness of hopes for years to come. We get through it, we celebrate, and then, finally, the Thanksgiving comes. Mary, would you light the chalice, please? Thank you. May the glory of the passing away of autumn lie about us, fresh gold for a time. And when the dark comes and the cold, may we remember how today we stand in glory, how we walk in bounty, heaped upon earth's dark carpet, how we move knee-deep in abundance, flung against night's winter curtain. We are thankful for its coming and for its passing. Let it be. November by Mary Oliver. The snow began slowly, a soft and easy sprinkling of flakes, then clouds of flakes in the baskets of the wind and the branches of the trees. Oh, so pretty. We walked through the growing stillness as the flakes prickled the path, then covered it, then deepened as in curds and drifts. As the wind grew stronger, shaping its work less delicately, taking greater steps over the hills and through the trees until, finally, we were cold and far from home. We turned and followed our long shadows back to the house, stamped our feet, went inside, and shut the door. Through the window, we could see how far it was to the gates of April. Let the fire now put on its red hat and sing to us. Through the window, we could see how far away it was to the gates of April, writes Oliver. I am not a fan of winter, as many of you know. I am already anticipating those gates of April, or at least thinking about them, mainly in terms of light. There's more light then. But setting aside the obvious for just a minute, that I should never, ever wish time away. The years go by so quickly, life is short, and all of that. I know this intellectually, but I have a difficult time getting to a place where I can accept the fact that I am here in this moment at the end of November in Wisconsin, and that I can't control the weather. Well, then I remember there is a cure of sorts for this, at least for me, short of somehow figuring out how to spend my entire winters in the Southwest. I return to meditation. Now, some of you have heard my tales about my beginnings in the world of trying to meditate, how when I was in seminary, I took a first semester, I had a class with Joanna Macy, one of my idols, my mentor, an amazing teacher, well-known in Buddhist circles, and on the first day, this was not labeled, this was not described as a Buddhist introduction or anything about Buddhism. On the very first day, she said, "We're meditating now for 20 minutes. That's a long time. We just went a minute and a half in silent meditation. I'm trying to get us to 2 minutes. Okay, so I fell asleep. I wasn't the only one who fell asleep, and she was not happy with us. Obviously, you all are not getting enough sleep, she said. Eventually, I learned a lot about meditation. I did take an introductory course in Buddhism from a Sri Lankan monk. I didn't understand a great deal of it, but I did learn a bit about meditating, and I do know that I am much more focused, I am much calmer, I have more energy if I just spend 15 to 20 minutes a day meditating. But don't worry, we're not going to spend this service meditating. I know that just really scares some of you. It wasn't the thought, the dread of having to go through winter, though, that prompted my having a little talk with myself about the importance of meditation and wondering why I stopped, because I do stop from time to time. I don't have enough discipline or something. I always wonder that when I go for these long periods of time without meditating, why? Why do I do this? But anyway, it wasn't about winter. It was about listening and how lacking most of us are in listening skills. There are many reasons why we don't know how to listen. We don't get any training. How many of you learned how to listen from kindergarten on up? We don't learn this. We don't practice enough. We are too busy, especially during the holidays. We are too focused on ourselves. There are too many distractions in our lives. These are just some of the reasons that come to mind. And there it was, my title for today's reflections. All I want for Christmas is to be a better listener. That is, to be more Buddhist in my daily life. In her book, It's Easier Than You Think, Buddhist teacher, author, psychologist, leader of countless meditation retreats, Sylvia Boorstein puts it this way. If I want to build big biceps, I need to use every opportunity to practice lifting weights. If I want to live in a way that is loving and generous and fearless, then I need to practice overcoming any tendency to be angry or greedy or confused. Life is a terrific gym. Every situation is an opportunity to practice. In formal Buddhist language, this is called the cultivation of non-hatred, non-greed, and non-delusion. One of the primary goals of mindfulness, which is the point of meditation, where meditation should take you, is to keep is to help us focus our minds on this. And again, Bornstein's words. Every single act we do has the potential of causing pain. And every single thing we do has consequences that echo way beyond what we can imagine. It doesn't mean we shouldn't act. It means we should act carefully. Everything matters. Meditation is one of the best ways that I know of to become a better listener, thus becoming more mindful. And I want to be mindful. But often I seem to be mindless. Any of you who read the comic strips, yes, I still read the comic strips. Yes, I still read a printed newspaper. I don't know how much longer this will be. Yeah, go on. But there's a cartoon called Pickles. And it's a couple of people who are a bit older than I am, who they're very funny. They also have a funny cat and a funny dog. So one day, he walks into the living room, and his wife's sitting there, and she says, "I'm practicing mindfulness. I'm living in the moment. I'm learning to contemplate and appreciate everything around me." "You should try it, Earl," she says to her husband. "I am." Last frame, he says, "I'm contemplating and appreciating this Kleenex before I blow my nose into it." So he's not quite getting it. Okay, next day, their daughter is there. Mom's meditating. "What's up with Mom?" "She's Earl," her husband says, "she's practicing mindlessness." That means you just sit and think about sitting and thinking. Of course, his wife says, "It is not mindlessness. It's mindfulness." You can tell she's angry. And then Earl says, "It's supposed to make you feel calm and serene, but I don't think it's working." And then there was a Zitz cartoon from several years ago where, what's his name, Jeremy, says to his girlfriend, "My new philosophy is to live in the moment. Unless the moment, you know, sucks. Then I live in some other moment." Girlfriend Sarah says, "Works for me." Recently, one of you asked me to stop using capital letters in my emails. It had not occurred to me that capitalizing certain words and or phrases could be seen as scolding or condescending. I do it to try to get the attention of the reader because, well, how many of you read your emails carefully anymore? None of us do that. How many of you read it to the end? Waste time. How many of you read our Prairie Fire newsletter every month to the end? I know you're not reading it because you ask me questions that are in there. Prairie Fire, that's okay, you can ask me the question. Prairie Fire and emails are forms of listening. We had a discussion at last week's parish meeting that I think illustrates how badly we listen to each other. It was the last agenda item. People were tired, ready to leave. The discussion was about whether or not to use our offering once a month for worthy causes, rather than use that offering as a source of revenue for Prairie. Or all of it for Prairie. I have to admit, at first I wasn't paying much attention to the discussion. I too was tired and ready to leave. Eventually, though, I realized that there were at least two different conversations going on. Now, please note, I don't want to have this discussion again this morning, so I'm not taking any comments on this. I will after the service, but not during congregational response time. The motion passed, and we will at least try out the idea of having a special collection once a month and see what happens. One of the conversations during the discussion of the motion seemed to be about the purpose of even passing the offering plate, in our case baskets, because many of you who pledge regularly, you don't put your pledges into the offering because you send it in separately or it's taken automatically out of your banking accounts or whatever. One consequence of this is that the plate can end up looking a little skimpy, by the time it gets to the back rows. Okay. But there was another conversation occurring that was more about the importance of giving above and beyond pledges to support social action, social justice, worthy causes. Both conversations were valid, though perhaps each missed the point. One seemed to be completely missing the point, and the other seemed unable to state the issue more clearly and forcefully. I'm not sure that we were listening carefully to each other. I think that we were really trying to have a conversation about generosity and also about privilege, which is my new favorite word. And I think that we were also rehashing a subject that is as old as Unitarian Universalism, because we are, by and large, people of privilege. How do we see the world as it really is? How do we tap into the Buddhist interpretation of the world, full of the underprivileged? And then how do we act accordingly, live our lives to make a difference in that unequal equation? How do we not feel guilty? That's all I'm saying about that right now. When I don't listen to you carefully, I fail to see your inherent worth and dignity. When we don't listen carefully to each other, we're in danger of being disrespectful. Not to mention of hindering that free and responsible search for truth and meaning and the use of the democratic process within our congregation. But the discussion was good practice for calming the mind and practicing attentive listening. Being more Buddhist means being, or trying to be, mindful every day, all the time, everywhere, in all situations. Sylvia Boorstein says that people often say to her, "Surely you don't go around all day monitoring your breathing or reciting blessings. How could you work? How could you have a life?" Her response is very Zen Buddhist. She says, "Practicing 100% of the time does not require any time. I do not spend my life noticing my breath or reciting blessings. I simply try to stay unconfused. And when I am confused, I try to do something about it. And I know whether or not I am confused most readily by noticing, by being mindful of my capacity for feeling caring concern. The lively impulse of caring is what counts. Practice, practice, practice. Practice mindfulness. Practice paying attention. Practice being grateful, because gratitude is part of that practice. Gratitude for life, for all that we have. Gratitude for everything, the good and the bad, the joy and the sorrow, the struggles and the victories. Once we get better at calming our mind and thus becoming ever more mindful of what is," and I have "is" in italics, I don't know how to say italics for a word, "what is," it's like those capital letters in my emails, I want to emphasize it, "what really is," as we get better and better at being in the moment, being here right now, then we also will become more accomplished listeners. This will not happen overnight, nor even in X number of years. Remember the taste of Banzo's sword in the story. We could substitute the word listening for the word swordsmanship in the story, because we can't put a time limit on how long it takes to master the art of listening, or the art of swordsmanship, or the art of ballet, for that matter. You have to be ready to defend yourself from the unexpected thrusts, or whatever the equivalent is, to learn how to listen better. Boorstein tells a story about the time she was sitting at her computer writing when her close friend Martha called to say that her brother Jack's illness had just taken a turn for the much worse, a man whom Boorstein knew. She went back to her writing after she'd spoken to her friend, trying to remember a thought that she had had when the phone rang. She couldn't recall it. And she thought to herself, "So inconvenient of Jack to get worse just today." Then she thought, "Oh, where did that unkind thought come from?" She turned off the computer. She lit a candle, and she sat for a while in a favorite chair, looking out the window. Of this experience, she says, What my heart wants most to do is to console or appreciate or encourage. It feels better in relationship. I imagine my heart always on the lookout for an object, a frightened friend, my own chagrined self, the world around me that it can connect with. And I love it that my heart reminds me, turn off the computer, light a candle, pay attention, even when, or perhaps especially when, I seem not to be listening. Our minds forget what they know. Our minds easily get confused and forget that what we yearn for is caring connection. Meditation helps unconfuse us. There are 3 steps in rescuing our minds from confusion. 1, relax. 2, breathe. And 3, pay attention to what's happening. The point is to keep your mind steady no matter what is happening. Some of you will know the famous Zen Buddhist story about the samurai warrior who terrorized a town so that everybody left, and then pretty soon all the monks left, really scary guy, bad guy, and there was only the abbot of the monastery left. But he didn't flee. And the warrior comes in and brandishes his sword, no doubt he was a master swordsman, and shouts, "Don't you know that I am the kind of man who could run you through with my sword without batting an eye?" The abbot responds with a slight bow, palms pressed together as a show of respect, and says, "And I, sir, am the kind of man who can be run through by a sword without batting an eye." The warrior becomes a disciple of that Zen master. What does this koan mean? Now, sometimes we use that word koan to mean story, but the dictionary definition is fascinating. Koan, a paradox used in Zen Buddhism as an instrument of meditation in training monks to despair of an ultimate dependence upon reason and to force them into sudden intuitive enlightenment. Not exactly Unitarian. That's why I like it. As you might imagine, there are many interpretations of the koan I just told you. The one I especially like is that the story illustrates the fundamental truth that the Buddha taught. The fact that suffering arises with this need we have, this imperative in our minds to have things be different from what they are. I think that's a variation on that definition of insanity. It's when you keep doing the same thing over and over, hoping that you'll change the reality. The story is, of course, a reminder that no matter what, no matter how bad things are, it is important to keep our minds steady and to remember that what the mind and the heart want is connection, caring relationships. We are so easily distracted from this truth. Distractions in the Buddhist literature are also known as disturbing energies. I don't know how to say this word because it's in Pali. Kalishas, hindrances. I like that word because these distractions hinder our mind's ability to clearly see and grasp what's happening. And we humans are very good at throwing up roadblocks of distractions and hindrances. Here's one of my favorite stories that illustrates how good we are at distracting ourselves from what really is happening. This is a true story. There was a group of people who met to meditate and try to get, have a sangha, be better meditators, in San Francisco not all that many years ago. And Sylvia Borstein was their meditation leader. Well, one day, a woman came in to this group and said, "Yesterday, when I went out of my apartment building in San Francisco to go to work, I noticed that I seemed to be inserting my key into my car door at a lower level than usual. Then I noticed that all 4 tires had been stolen during the night. And my car was sitting on its hubs. I got so upset," she says, "that I walked to the Stonestown Shopping Mall It's only 3 miles from where I live, and I bought the pair of silk pajamas that I had seen several days ago in Macy's window and had been coveting. Then I went home and called the police. You did that? One of the men in the group said, I would have gone back into the house, found the superintendent, and given her a piece of my mind. A part of my rent is supposed to go for security around the building. And then I would have gone to work and probably have given everyone there a bad time. When I am mad, I lose patience with everyone. Someone else said, I can't take that kind of stress. I would have gone back into my apartment, called work, told them I was having a bad day and needed the day off. I have told them I'd be in tomorrow, and then maybe I would have called the police. A woman who had been in a class for a long time laughingly said, well, I guess you can all imagine my response. I would have thought, today the tires, tomorrow the car. My motto, she said, is, when you aren't sure, worry. Everyone laughed. Yet another person added, I would have given myself a bad time for picking the neighborhood. I can just hear my mind saying, once again, you chose stupidly. Maybe I have some kind of genetic lack of confidence. Even though I am doing pretty well, I obsess over making decisions and I blame myself when things go wrong. Well, by this time, everyone in the group was laughing. They recognized that each one had, you know, a valid response, maybe a valid response, but definitely responses to distract themselves from what had really happened. Borstein says that we tell stories to ourselves over and over and over again. We bewilder and frighten ourselves, forgetting that the dismay and fear are always about one of two things, what might have been or what might yet be. But what isn't happening now, right now. We also forget that what's happening now is not going to be happening for very long. To that, I would add that it isn't about us. It's about all of us. Borstein saw this sign in a store near her home. Be careful of the words you use. Keep them short and sweet. You never know from day to day which ones you'll have to eat. That reminded her of the saying, some of you will remember, from the 1960s, let it all hang out. Borstein says that she contemplated writing a book called Holding It All in response to this, because she was worried that letting it all hang out ignored our vulnerability, overlooked how vulnerable each of us is. She never wrote the book, but she did revise the title not too long ago while in a whimsical mood. Holding it all in until we figured out how to say it in a useful way. The title of one of the essays in Borstein's book, It's Easier Than You Think, is what I am about to say an improvement over maintaining silence? The Buddha believed in complete honesty, yes, but he also taught that everything a person says should be truthful and helpful. Speaking is yet another form of listening. I try very hard to observe the 60-second rule with email 24-hour rule, minimum, unless it's an emergency, of course. In her meditation classes, Borstein uses an exercise that goes like this. Anytime a person asks a question, the respondent needs to pause 60 seconds before answering. Since the pause is obligatory, the likelihood is that the answer will include reflection, examination of intention, and preview of tone. All the things that make for a wise response. I wish that we had practiced that during our discussion about giving at last week's parish meeting. Then maybe we would have ended up with one conversation instead of at least two. One thing that we know for sure is what is happening right now. And for that, we give thanks. Another thing we know for sure is, as I said earlier, every single act we do has the potential of causing pain. It doesn't mean we shouldn't act, it means we should act carefully. Everything matters. All I want for Christmas is to be more Buddhist. I want to be a better listener. I want us to act carefully, always keeping in mind two things. One, we don't know what the other person's point of view is. And two, we do know that our hearts want connection and right relationship with others. And one more reason that I want my holiday gift to myself to be becoming more Buddhist, one of the realities that Zen Buddhism teaches us is that as we begin to see more clearly, we become more mindful of our interconnectedness to everything and of our interdependence with all other beings. In another of Sylvia Boorstein's books, Pay Attention for Goodness' Sake, she says this: suppose people everywhere simultaneously stopped what they were doing and paid attention for only as long as it took to recognize their shared humanity. Surely, the heartbreak of the world's pain, visible to all, would convert everyone to kindness. What a gift that would be. This is my potential gift, not only to myself, but also to you. I know some of you are thinking, ugh, that seems impossible. Pie in the sky stuff, especially when we live with a whole new brand of terrorism and fear. Who believes this? Who thinks this will work? Kindness, compassion, easy to do in here, huh? But what's the alternative out there? The path that humanity is on doesn't seem to be working real well. What's supposed to happen if and when we meditate? What's supposed to happen if we become more mindful and pay attention to what is? The practice of mindfulness, of really listening to each other, will let us see clearly, will lead us to become the compassionate people that we were meant to be. Gratitude goes hand in hand with compassion. One more story. During the, the most recent Buddha's lifetime, if there's one out there, I am unaware of it. I mean, one living one at the moment. He had many followers, as a lot of you know, many people who thought of him as their teacher, men and women, very important, men and women. As word of the wisdom of the Buddha's teaching, the peacefulness of his demeanor, and the depth of his compassion became widespread, people began to imagine him a deity. In one story, a follower asked him, "Are you a god?" "No," the Buddha replied. "Are you some other kind of celestial being?" "No," the Buddha replied again. "Are you then a plain man?" "No," the Buddha replied for the third time. "What are you then?" the person asked. The Buddha said, "I am awake." There's a postscript to the story. Boorstein says that she wishes that one more question had been asked of the Buddha, and it is this: what do you see that I don't see now that you are awake? And then she imagines that the Buddha's response might have been, "I see how much suffering there is in the world, and I see that its remedy is compassion." And speaking of religious figures who are sometimes mistaken for God, Pope Francis has been in Africa, still talking about climate change, go Pope. But a couple of days ago in Kenya, he had some forceful things to say about communication and listening to each other. He was in a meeting with Kenyan Christians and Muslims, leaders of these communities. The Pope said, "Dialogue is not a luxury. It is not something extra or optional, but essential. We must learn how to listen better, how to listen to each other, yes, but also how to listen to what's coming out of our own mouths." I hope that we leave this precious place today with more compassion in our hearts than we had when we entered this space. Hand in hand with compassion goes gratitude. As Sylvia Boorstein, I think, would say, meditation isn't just sitting for a while. It's always ongoing in the sense of calming your mind. And you can do that when you're standing in line at the grocery store, which where it's sometimes very necessary. You can always do that. You can always just calm your mind no matter what is going on around you. The closing words settle in. This is a blessing, if you will, that my family has used for a very long time at Thanksgiving. It's whimsical. Let us give thanks for the bounty of people, for children who are our second planting, and though they grow like weeds and the wind too soon blows them away, may they forgive us our cultivation and fondly remember where their roots are. Let us give thanks for generous friends with hearts as big as Hubbard's and smiles as bright as their blossoms, for feisty friends as tart as apples, for continuous friends who, like scallions and cucumbers, keep reminding us that we've had them, for crotchety friends as sour as rhubarb and as indestructible, for handsome friends who are as gorgeous as eggplants and as elegant as a row of corn, and the others, as plain as potatoes and as good for you, for funny friends who are as silly as Brussels sprouts and as amazing as Jerusalem artichokes, and serious friends as complex as cauliflowers and as intricate as onions, for friends as unpretentious as cabbage, as subtle as summer squash, as persistent as parsley, as delightful as dill, as endless as zucchini, and who, like parsnips, can be counted on to see you through the winter. For old friends nodding like sunflowers in the evening time, and young friends coming on as fast as radishes, for loving friends who wind about us like tendrils and hold us despite our blights, wilts, and witherings. And finally, for those friends now gone, like gardens past that have been harvested, and who fed us in their times that we might have life thereafter. For all these, we give thanks. Go in peace, be here now, as the Buddhists would say, greet your neighbors.